The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by life's difficulties or a traumatic experience? You are not alone. Welcome to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving with Lisa Ference. Today, you'll hear from professionals and everyday people who understand the impact of life's challenges and the personal growth and newfound meaning that can come from the healing journey. Listen, pay it forward, and your life could change too. Now, here is your host, Lisa Ference.
Welcome. I'm Lisa Ference, and this is Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. I'm delighted that you can join us, and I'm especially glad that you're listening to a topic that needs and deserves a lot of attention. Today, we're going to be talking about intimate partner violence. My guest for today is Dave Thomas, and those of us who are privileged enough to call him a close friend and colleague can speak to his incredible passion about this subject and how truly dedicated he is to educating people about domestic violence as well as advocating for victims' rights. He has an incredible bio. I'm just going to share a small portion of it with you, but I think you'll be able to hear just how accomplished he is. Dave was on the Montgomery County Police Department for 15 years and retired in 2000. And in fact, his final assignment there was the founding of their domestic violence unit. He was also responsible for the department's curriculum and policy development for domestic violence training and related issues. Dave was the second highest decorated officer in the history of the department, receiving both the silver and bronze medals of valor, as well as numerous prestigious awards for his work in domestic violence in the community, including being honored at the White House as a champion of change. Dave is involved in domestic violence curriculum, policy development, and training on state, federal, and international levels. And currently, he is at Johns Hopkins University, where he serves as the program administrator of the Domestic Violence Education Program, as well as a faculty member in the Division of Public Safety Leadership. A truly, truly accomplished man and a dear friend. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So I think it makes sense for us to start at the beginning. Can you define for our listening audience what we mean when we talk about intimate partner violence and some of the various ways in which it can manifest in relationships?
Yes, of course. Intimate partner violence, the term itself can be misleading because when we think of violence, we often only think of the physical, but when we're talking about intimate partner violence, we're talking abusive behaviors by one individual against another in an intimate relationship, which causes that other individual emotional and or physical harm. So it can manifest in numerous ways, and whomever is the individual in the relationship who is the one responsible for this behavior, they basically utilize whatever tactics and or physical or psychological types of behaviors that work best within their relationship. And it's based on how the individuals who they are subjecting this behavior to, it's based on what works with them. So In one relationship, it might look a lot different than it does in another relationship. The thing to really focus on is how is the recipient of the behavior, how are they responding and reacting to it?
So I think part of what you just said there that's important is that we're not just talking about physical violence here. We're talking also about, as you said, emotional and psychological.
Absolutely. In fact, when working with survivors throughout my career, it when we talk to them, they often state that the psychological, emotional type of abuse is much more, it impacts them much more than the physical abuse. And I always like to say, you know, a black eye will in a week, in a month, you don't even, you hardly even notice you had it. You might not even remember it, but those psychological weapons that are used, those scars last for years, if not decades.
Mm. And, you know, it makes me wonder then that people who are being abused in those kinds of ways may not consider it abuse if it's not physical.
Absolutely. In fact, they often don't. They say, well, I'm not being physically subjected to negative types of behavior, so I can't be an abused person. When in fact, the type of abuse, the psychological, like I said, tends to be a lot more impactful on the recipient of that type of abuse.
Yeah. So I know that when we talk about violence, intimate partner violence, the dynamics of power and control, right? Those are very fundamental components of what we're talking about. Can you describe some of the power and control tactics that abusers are likely to use in these situations?
Certainly. You know, power and control is, I like to talk about it as a constellation of behaviors utilized by someone in the relationship to have superiority over the other individual in that relationship. And so it goes beyond just the physical and or sexual abuse and includes things like isolation, isolating the individual from people, friends, family, anybody who will have an effect on the survivor that gives them the ability to try to push back against their abuser. So by isolating them, they're taking care, taking away their resources. There's intimidation. It may be through threats. It may be through physical violence, but intimidation is a factor that we often see. If there are children involved in the relationship, these individuals will also do things either directly at the children or do things like threaten to take away the children from the survivor so that the survivor isn't able to see or be with them again. And be in mind, as I mentioned, these are all happening pretty much in concert. They're co-occurring types of behaviors, once again, so that abuser can try to maintain superiority over the victim. They will use men against women, in fact, will use what's termed male privilege. In other words, telling that individual, you know, it's a man's world and this is what women are meant to do, and that you're a second-class citizen and you have to listen to me, that type of thing. And these are also what is constant among survivors. In other words, what they continue to tell us manifest in their relationships. Now, every relationship isn't going to include all of these, but what we find in a lot of abusive relationships, these are the same things that keep popping up.
So I'm hearing that there must be a kind of cumulative effect where the victim is feeling, as you say, more and more disconnected, more isolated, and therefore more helpless, more powerless to be able to extricate him or herself from that scenario.
Absolutely. It's a thing of really just beating the person down. So they just don't have the wherewithal to be able to resist, and they succumb to the power and control of the abuser. What we do find, though, as this goes on for months or years and so forth, the victim or survivor many times finally does find the reservoirs of strength to break away. And that's when we start seeing these types of relationships get more dangerous for the survivor. When we know for a fact that 65% of those murdered or seriously injured in an intimate partner relationship is when they try to put a permanent end to the relationship, whether it's a divorce decree, child custody is decided, protection order is issued. That's when it becomes very dangerous. And it's because this survivor has unilaterally said no more. And they're going to get away. And this challenge to that abuser's power and control is something that they really can't deal with. And they act out much more violently at that point.
So the frightening thing that I'm hearing you say is that in some ways a victim is more at risk when they find the courage to try to leave.
Absolutely. That is definitely the most dangerous time. And that's the time where they really need to reach out to their local service providers so that safety planning can be done with them, so that we can do what's called a lethality assessment, so we can really ask some specific questions and tell them why, in fact, if the proper markers are there, why we are in fear for their safety. Now, every relationship, this isn't gonna be true. There are certain markers, and that's why the lethality assessment questions are asked. We can see if the individual, for instance, owns a firearm, if the individual has threatened to murder the victim at any point, if they've threatened to commit suicide, if they have strangled the victim in the past, if they have sexually assaulted the victim in the past, this also has a cumulative effect. It's about a 20-question screen, and based on the answers, based on those responses, we can tell a person what level of danger they're in. And this is based on over 20 years of research into intimate partner relationships in which the survivor was ultimately murdered by their abuser.
Wow. So the issue of lethality is huge, and I'm hearing that you need to be putting the situation really into context, looking at the history, looking at things that have already happened, I guess, in the relationship as a way to know if there are tipping points that would make the victim less safe if she were to actually try to leave.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you used that term, context. Context is everything. When I go and look at a relationship, I need to know the history. I need to know everything that's going on so I can get a clear picture of what's happening. And so I can get a clear picture over who in fact is the true abuser, because, you know, some studies come out to say that men are women are just as violent in these relationships as men are. And if you take that, and if you look at the research, you know, many times that does, the raw research that is, what it says, but you have to look at at everything involved. And many times, because the research in some of those doesn't take into account self-defense. It doesn't take into account that this person has perhaps been being bullied by the abuser in the relationship, also termed as the predominant aggressor in the relationship, and finally fought back. I often give the example of the schoolyard bully, who the kid who's been bullied and bullied and bullied. They finally fight back, and then the kid who fights back gets suspended.
Right.
And because the school often doesn't take the time to look at everything that led up to the kid finally fighting back. I mean, if you get your lunch money stolen from a bully for a month straight, you know, and the bullies, the way they approach you is the same every time they come up, and they push you in the chest and they say, give me your money. And if you don't, you get punched in the face. And then, you know, a month later, you come up, the bully comes up, puts his hand out, and then goes to push you in the chest, and you punch him before before he's able to punch you. It makes it look like you just hauled off and hit somebody who didn't hit you.
Yeah, and my sense is, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is in many of those situations then, when there is that tipping point and the woman finally does in some way become aggressive or retaliate, that often there is that underpinning of history where she has endured perhaps years of victimization before she reached that place of being aggressive in return.
Absolutely. When you really look at the underlying issues and so forth, you find that. And, you know, when I'm training police officers, the way I've been able to get them to get it and to police differently, rather than just lock up who hit who first, I say, okay, I tell the officer, you respond to my house. And there's been a reported domestic violence incident. And I'm telling you, you know, I got to be at work in 5 minutes. You got to finish this report up. And you as the officer say to me, sir, I'll finish when the report. You can go as soon as I'm done. And if you as the officer know that I, who you're talking to, have fought police in the past, are you going to take that into account when you're talking to me? Even if it was 2 years ago that me as the citizen fought the police. Mm-hmm. And if I go to make a quick move, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and when you do go to protect yourself, when you do go to take me down, are you going to put in your use of force report the fact that you reacted as quickly as you did and like you did because I am a known police fighter and you took that type of action in order to get me under control?
Right.
Boom, they get it.
So in the minute before our first break, I want to ask, because I want to be careful not to be too stereotypical about this, but is the victim always female and the perpetrator always male in your experience?
No. That would be, that is something that I would never advocate and say that it's always like that. When we look at domestic violence situation, intimate partner violence, we find that the majority of the time, the perpetrator, the ongoing perpetrator is male and the ongoing victim is female. But we also have, we've had numerous incidents, and I've had incidents myself, where the predominant aggressor was the female. And that's why each and every time we have to take the case, putting everything into context with the facts in that case. Mm-hmm. I can go in knowing that this is what happens most of the time, but I can't automatically make that assumption. If I hear, for instance, I'm sitting here in a parking lot and I hear that there's a carjacking, and I see the two cars that meet the description, one going to the right, the other going to the left, and one has two males in it and the other has two females in it, who am I going to follow?
Yeah.
Well, I believe the two males, because the majority of carjackings are committed by males. That doesn't say that females don't commit carjackings, but it would be my best bet. And if I pulled them over, found out it wasn't them, I'd cut them loose and then go and try to find a female.
Right, right.
But when it comes to violent crime in this country overall, the vast majority are committed by males. So that it's no surprise that this type of criminal activity, this type of abusive behavior is not also predominantly male.
Okay. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, I want to talk more about the police response to domestic violence calls, because I know that you've put so much work into, frankly, retraining officers so that they can respond more effectively. And I also want to talk about what I think is a myth in our culture, that abusers get provoked by their victims. And so that's why they, react in the ways that they do. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue the conversation. Please stay with us.
Which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrantz, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrantz's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound, inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe.
And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We are talking with Dave Thomas about intimate partner violence. So, Dave, I want to pick up the conversation where we were in terms of the police response, first responders to domestic violence calls. And maybe if you can talk a little bit about how they were trained and then what needs to change in terms of how they're responding.
Yeah. Now, the traditional response for law enforcement up into really the early 80s, and it didn't change, or it didn't start to be a sea change until the late 80s. We responded to a call for domestic violence. We separated the parties. We perhaps had, the man walk around the block, or get somewhere else to stay that night, and then we went back into service without so much as even taking a report. Now, mind you, this was whether or not we saw injuries or anything. Then it started to change a little bit in that if we saw injuries, we would actually ask the victim, do you want this individual arrested? And most of the time, they would say no. So he said,
can
fine,
I ask
you don't want arrested?
Can I ask, was that question asked in the presence of the man?
Yes, it was, and that was going to be my next point. We were asking this ongoing victim if they wanted this individual arrested in the presence of their abuser. Okay. And which, in hindsight being 2020, it's absolutely insane to put a person in that type of predicament. And mind you, there was no other type of crime where we asked the victim whether or not they wanted the perpetrator locked up. There was never an armed robbery of a bank where the bank manager was asked whether we wanted the robber locked up. We went and locked him up, and it was because they broke the law. And we started to realize that it's not the victim's law, it's the state's law. This is a violation against the state, and the state is thus responsible for holding the individual accountable. And we started realizing the unfair predicament we were putting victims in. And so after some large lawsuits nationally, there started to be a change, and we started to realize that the law does not stop at the doorstep. That the Constitution exists behind closed doors, and that it is not a private family matter. It's a matter in keeping citizens safe, like we are sworn to do. And it means going in, doing a good, sound investigation, and when somebody has violated the law, holding them accountable for violation of the law.
So, in other words, we've now, police officers have moved beyond deferring to the judgment of the victim in terms of whether or not the alleged perpetrator is going to be arrested.
Yes, they definitely have, because we found the error of our ways in doing that.
So in your estimation, because I know this is the world that you live in and you do so much training of police officers, are they getting it right now? Do they do it correctly when they show up on a domestic violence call?
they are doing so much of a better job than in 1986 when I first came on the department. There's been a sea change. It's been almost a 100% reversal on the way that we used to respond. The attitude is different. The way that this type of violence, this type of criminal activity is viewed is totally, it really is totally different. And a lot of that is because, you know, the departments have pretty much changed their whole police force, because a lot of the individuals with the antiquated attitudes have retired. And younger officers have come on with a whole different attitude about intimate partner violence, about women's rights, and just about, you know, upholding the law and seeing this as a violation of the law.
And hopefully also being more sensitive to the impact this has on children who witness intimate partner violence.
Absolutely, and seeing how this environment, for a child to come up in this environment, if nothing else, realizing that that child is being psychologically abused, if not physically or sexually abused, because we know in half the situations where there is ongoing violence between two adults, if children are in that home, they're being either physically or sexually abused. So, and that's another point that has to be realized. There's a lot of co-occurring behaviors going on where one abusive type of dysfunction is going on in a household. Thus, when we go in there, we have to look for, the co-occurring, types of abuse and try to address all of them. And it's all, once again, it's like you said before, bringing everything into context.
Yeah. And I don't know if I'm correct in assuming this, but perhaps alcohol or drugs also being a disinhibitor that becomes a factor in the equation.
Absolutely. The alcohol and drugs, you know, I'm always careful to point out that they do not cause the abuse, but there is a correlative factor there. They are, as you said, a disinhibitor. Thus, someone who has abusive tendencies, will tend to be more abusive with the addition of alcohol and or drugs into the equation. It's almost like throwing gasoline on a fire. But it's also important to remember there are some individuals who don't imbibe in alcohol and take no drugs who are every bit as abusive individuals who are more abusive with the addition of alcohol and drugs. But the alcohol and drugs just make a bad situation worse.
Yeah, good. No, I'm glad that you're pointing that out. Why do you think victims are so reluctant to press charges, or has that changed too? Maybe I should ask it differently. Are you finding that more victims are willing to press charges, or is there still resistance about that?
Well, you know, it's first of all, the system shouldn't be set up so that it's dependent on the victim even participating at all in the whole thing. That's why we try now to do evidence-based investigation, so that the evidence can, get an individual convicted if, in fact, you know, they're correctly charged and so forth. The victim, what we have to look at, and I think it's real important for the audience to realize, you know, the victim, many times they've got to concentrate on surviving. It might not be the top thing on their list to get this individual either arrested or convicted. And many of these individuals still have strong feelings for their abuser. For most of these individuals, it isn't all bad times. There are many, many good times that they've had with this individual. So they might have some conflicting types of feelings there. They also have kids to think about. There are cultural issues that might come into play, religious issues that might come into play, and it's unfair for me or anybody else sitting on the outside looking in saying what they should do. Well, all I can do is give them the facts, give them the options, and then let them make choices based on how they think that they need to best navigate the system. From the law enforcement standpoint, if we do that good evidence-based investigation, then it's not going to be necessary for them to have to participate in the whole thing. And, you know, for individuals out there who think for a second that if I don't have the victim testifying, I'm not going to make the case, I have to remind them that there have been decades and decades of murder cases made, and a victim has never testified in one of those cases.
Good. And I'm also really glad that you brought up some of the reasons why it is so hard for victims to leave an abusive relationship. Because I can tell you as a therapist, this is certainly an issue that I've had to deal with my clients. And I think there can be a lot of judgment within, you know, our culture, our society, about why doesn't she just pick up and leave?
It's an assumption that people make without any critical thinking going into it, because people are change averse, even if it's for something good, that everything is positive in. And just leaving at the drop of a hat, it just doesn't happen. Whether you think it would, or you would do this, that, or the other. And it's one of those things, don't judge me until you've walked in those shoes.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the issue of people believing, since we're talking about some of the cultural myths that exist in the community about this issue. I think there's an awful lot of people out there who believe that abusers abuse because they're provoked by their victims. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, that's oftentimes an excuse. What I believe for the most part is a myth that people, you know, they just lose their temper, or like you said, they're provoked, that they have control issues. And when you dial it back, when you really look into it, you find out that many of these individuals don't do it because they're provoked. They don't do it because they have anger issues or anything like that. In fact, most of them are in total control. Most of them, clinically, when you look at them, they don't have these things where they're not able to, that this little thing sets them off. And if you, going back to myself as a police officer, the same individual who just gets convicted of domestic violence, who said, well, he snapped, or he was provoked by his wife or girlfriend or whatever, and that's why he lashed out at him. If I, you know, outside the courthouse on the way home, if I pull him over and give him a ticket, 99 times out of 100, they're not going to peel out of the car and try to beat me into the ground. Why? Because they know they're going to be held accountable. These individuals lose, quote-unquote, lose control or become provoked, and then do that with individuals where they believe they're going to be able to get away with the behavior, or they're willing to pay they're willing to deal with the outcome of losing it after being provoked. When they don't want to pay that outcome, the reason they don't jump on me as an officer, it's not because I'm the baddest officer in the world, because they don't want to deal with what is going to happen after they attack a police officer.
Right. And I guess they understand that stuff will happen.
Absolutely.
And they probably also understand that in all likelihood nothing will happen if they go after a weaker partner.
Absolutely. And that's it right there. They don't want to deal with the consequences of what will happen if they attack me as an officer. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some who don't even care about that.
Yeah.
So there is a certain percentage, 5-10% of the population who they'll lose control no matter who it is, right? If they get mad, But then we're talking, you know, other psychological issues that are going on, and many times that is something that can be documented. But when we're talking the average abuser and so forth, they don't have those issues, but it's a convenient excuse so that they can say, you know, well, I wouldn't have done it if so-and-so hadn't done this, that, or the other. No, they don't want to take ownership for their behavior.
So you're saying something really important. You're saying that ultimately this is a choice that they make, you know,
Absolutely.
no matter what their partner did or didn't do or said or didn't say, the choice to throw them down the stairs is their choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess the other question that relates to this, and that is in some ways even sadder, is do you see that a lot of victims will also rationalize their abuser's behavior by buying into the idea that I must have done something to provoke him to the point where he got that angry at me?
Yeah, I definitely see that as definitely being true. The victim will often, well, both the victim and the perpetrator will minimize. And, you know, if I hadn't done this, he wouldn't have done that and everything. Sometimes that's because they may have grown up in an environment where they saw their mother abused in the same way. And, you know, sometimes this is termed as learned helplessness. And so they just figure, well, that's the way life is. Or, you know, that they have the loved ones who say, you know, you made your bed hard, now you got to sleep in it. That you know, we've heard that term used before. And so they think it's this may be their normal. And so that's how they have to navigate that world in which they live and have come up in. So it's not surprising when you see them minimizing. And oftentimes you can really hear it in a victim who has successfully left a relationship, and then, you know, 3 months later, 6 months later, when they have that 1,000-foot view of what was going on, they're like, I can't believe I put up with this, or I can't believe I did that, or what was I thinking? That happened. When we work with victims, we see that all the time. When they're right in the mix, it's hard for them to see it for what it really is.
Yeah. And as you suggested earlier, because this is something that I've seen a lot as well, oftentimes I think women in particular who are in these scenarios, they're more concerned about the safety of their kids or their kids' well-being, and really kind of put their own needs way on the back burner. So they will endure horrible stuff that's happening in the relationship if in their mind it's, you know, protects their kid from getting hurt more, or the house pet from getting hurt. Cause I'm imagining that abusers will threaten those kinds of acts of violence as well to keep a woman where she is in the house.
Absolutely. And that's a great point. And that's, you know, that using the children is one of the things. And I should also mention using the pets is the other thing. And once again, if you think about it, going with power and control, it's what tool can I utilize against her to make her do exactly what I want her to do? Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's understandable why he might go after the kids or after the pet. And, you know, I talk all the time about, you know, if this guy has, you know, if she has a pet or the kids have a pet, and that they really all care about and so forth, and, you know, he doesn't really care about the pets, but he has hunting dogs. He might abuse that pet, but he's not going to touch his hunting dogs, right? So it's not against animals per se. It's against animals that mean something to his target.
Yeah, it's knowing the emotional buttons to push, in a sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. Knowing those things to push. And it is so true that the victims oftentimes, their concern about self is not as much as it is about those pets, as it is about those kids. And it's oftentimes when he does go after either of those is when she finally says, I got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here. We got to get out of this whole thing. In fact, you know, there was recently in the last 5 to 10 years especially, many of the shelters have now also collaborated with the local humane society so that the animal could be put up at the same time the woman could go in the shelter, often because she wasn't leaving without her pets because she knew what would happen if she left him there with the pets.
Wow.
And so this is what the, by having these collaborations, more women were able to successfully get out. And, you know, with the lethality assessment, with one of the reasons that we've been doing that, one of the
things that we've seen when it comes to the recent drop in numbers of homicides here in the state of Maryland,
is as a result of victims being connected to services. That's what that whole, the assessment's all about, because we know nationally that when women are killed in these relationships, and many of the times they were never connected to services. So we figured if we can get them connected to services, we can save lives. And over 7 years, we've reduced the homicide rate from an average of 69 a year, plus or minus about five, for 25 years straight, down to, I believe last year, we were down to 37.
Oh, that's remarkable. That's a very significant change.
And we've had double-digit drops every year since we've started to institute this. And this is where, in Maryland, law enforcement, when they go to these calls, each and every time they do an assessment. And then they advise the victim if, in fact, based on the factors, what level of danger they're in. And then get on the phone and connect them to services. It's the only state in the country where every police department, all 115 agencies in the state, and all the counties and the local service providers are involved in doing this. And we've seen dramatic drop in homicide. So, you know, what we're talking about here is something that not only is theoretically responsible, but the numbers have proven it to be true.
And I think we've come full circle. We'll take a break in a moment, but just to reiterate, I think we've come full circle with this idea that when the victim is less isolated, more connected to services, we're going to get a better outcome. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the correlation between intimate partner abuse and family of origin issues and experiences. And my other question is going to be connected to, are we too desensitized to violence as a culture? I'm wondering if that plays a role in this issue as well. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book, Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe. And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We're talking to Dave Thomas about intimate partner violence. Dave, I want to go back to this idea about, is there a relationship between intimate partner violence and family of origin issues and experiences that both perpetrators and victims have?
Absolutely. What we know is that when it comes to perpetrators in particular, and even victims, that 80% grew up in homes where they at least witnessed, if not were the direct recipients of abusive behavior. So it means that it just says that, or it's proven that it makes one more predisposed, but it's not an absolute. When we look overall, only about a third of those who grow up, if we look from the other side, who grow up in an abusive environment, grow up to be abusive themselves or grow up to be victims themselves. And usually it's because somebody outside of the immediate family showed them a functional way to operate. You know, whether it was a relative or a teacher or a coach or something like that showed them a better way.
So in other words, if somebody who grew up in a dysfunctional or abusive home has access to a loving, nurturing figure, that's going to be a mitigating factor that might prevent the violence from going into the next generation.
Absolutely.
All right, that's good to know. What about, and you know, my kids actually make fun of me because they know this is such a big issue for me when I talk about my concerns about exposure that kids and teenagers have to very violent or misogynistic video games, films, you know, everything that they can access on the internet. Is there a correlation there between the stuff that younger kids are being exposed to, and does that make it more likely that they're going to either objectify women or think it's more okay to be emotionally, physically, sexually abusive towards women?
Yeah, well, you know, and that one's a little bit harder to drill down to, but when you look at the family of origin and when you look at the environment that the child grows up in, the more nurturing and healthy the environment the kid grows up in and is growing up in, the more they're going to be able to be resilient against the influences of misogynistic and violent types of materials. The more unhealthy the environment, the more they're going to be predisposed to acting out that way. Dr. James Garbarino wrote a book called Lost Boys, and in it he calls the kids who grow up in these dysfunctional environments, the more dysfunctional environment that they're in, the more they're going to be what he terms a psychological asthmatic, who is then more impacted by the social toxins that are out there, such as misogynistic and violent movies and video games and things of that sort.
Mm. Do you think, and you can answer this both as somebody who was in the police force for years and then given all the work you do now, are we too desensitized to violence, just, you know, as a culture in general?
I definitely think we are. I mean, because, you know, when we hear or see, you know, murder, suicides and intimate partner relationships go on and so forth, it's almost, it's to the point of where we hardly even hear it when it happens. And we still, in this country, three women die a day at the hands of their current or former intimate partner. You know, we're talking over 1,800 women dying at the hands of current or former intimate partners a year. And, you know, I call it a numbness to the violence because, you know, of the reaction. For instance, when we look at the first 6 years of the Iraqi conflict and see how many soldiers, were killed in the line of duty. And then we look back here at home and over that same 5 to 6 year period, no more than, twice that many women died at the hands of their current or former intimate partner. It's chilling, but people don't see it like that. But when they look at it that way, they're in disbelief because of numbness that we have to it.
I want to repeat that statistic. I think it is absolutely shocking. You're saying three women die every day at the hands of. That's extraordinary to me. So.
Yes.
Yeah, we need to make sure that people are hearing that. Let's talk a little bit about guns. And is there a relationship between the accessibility to guns, having a gun in the home, and partner violence?
There absolutely is. I mean, a gun in the home just by itself correlates to a threefold increase for risk of homicide in the home where that gun is. If you add the ingredient
of domestic violence going on in that same home where there's a gun, there's an eightfold increase in the risk of homicide. And when we talk about those 1,800 plus women a year killed in this country at the hands of their current or former intimate partner, 77% are by way of handgun. And so the gun in the home, really, when you look at the research, when you look at what came out of the gun violence summit at Johns Hopkins in January of this year, you find that more people in that home where the gun is are dying from firearms than anything. And you know, and one of the ways a lot of people don't realize is, it's not even, most of them aren't by way of homicide, but by the way of suicide. 51% of those, you know, who are dying in homes by way of suicide. So somebody in that home where the gun is there supposedly to protect people in that home, many more are dying, in that same home from that gun than a perpetrator or somebody coming in to do harm to anybody in the home.
So I'm assuming when we talked again about that, the issue of lethality and the lethality assessment, which is such an important part of treatment here and prophylactically protecting women, I'm assuming then that having a gun in the home, that's going to raise that another flag, yeah, in terms of lethality.
Absolutely. We know that having a gun in the home has been far more dangerous for women in the home, and more dangerous for women in the home than for men in the home. It's killing. 77% of those homicides are by way of handgun. So it's something that isn't protected for women.
Yeah. So, Do most victims eventually leave? I mean, we've tried to shed some light on why we need to be sensitive and compassionate to the fact that this is not an easy thing to extricate yourself from. You have the perpetrator who has been, I think, systematically chipping away at that victim's sense of self-worth, self-esteem. You have an isolated victim. You have a victim who has grave concerns about how she's going to financially provide for herself or for her children. So, and those are, I think, very real things that do keep people in relationships for way longer than they should be. So, but do they eventually leave in your experience? And if they do, how long on average does it take? Is there such a thing as an average of how long it takes a victim to leave a situation like this?
There is, and it's more of how many times have they attempted to leave. A woman in an abusive relationship tries to leave at an average of about 7 times before they successfully are able to extricate themselves from the relationship. Maybe they leave for 2 days and come back. Maybe they leave for a week and come back, things like that. So we average about 7 times. But what we also know is that women in these types of abusive relationships leave more often and leave sooner than women in relationships that are bad, where there is no abusive behavior going on. It just happens to be a bad relationship. So women in abusive relationships are leaving sooner in the relationship, and they're leaving more often in the relationship. So we know that's happening. What we're finding, though, is if they haven't found skills for making certain that they choose a healthy partner, then they may choose the same type of partner that they had in the first relationship and then find themselves in a successive abusive relationship.
Which sadly, you know, you're exactly right. It's sort of jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
And I would say that I think if a woman has a prior history of childhood trauma or abuse, and as you said earlier, it's been normalized to be treated in that way, she's even more vulnerable to winding up in a relationship that is just as horrible as the one that she found the courage to leave.
Absolutely. And if I don't know, if nobody has ever modeled for me or told me
what is bad in when it comes to attributes of somebody, of a significant other, how am I to know that? That's not something that is innate. That's not something that you're just born knowing. And many of us say, well, you know, I would have never chosen this person because of A, B, C, D, and E. And we assume we just know that because everybody knows that. And that's not the case. Everybody doesn't know that. Those of us who do know that, we're lucky enough to grow up in an environment in which somebody modeled that for us, or maybe told us directly, but we saw it happening somewhere, and we said, "Yeah, you know, that's what I want." And that's part of the reason that we picked the partners that we picked, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, great, excellent point. You're right. So in the minute that we have before we close, I'd like to leave people with a sense of hope and optimism. I think it's important to say that even though we've listed a lot of reasons why it is difficult for women to leave these relationships, that there is help out there, and that when they do get support and they do reach out to other people and recognize that there's nothing to be ashamed of, and then they can get out of these relationships and lead very meaningful lives. I will say that I've had the great privilege of watching several women in the course of my career, you know, get out of very abusive relationships and then go on to have, with support and with therapy, go on to have very loving, very safe, very meaningful relationships. So we want to end on that note, that anybody who is in a bad situation, to not give up and to not feel totally helpless about it. Is there a national hotline number, Dave, that maybe we could close with, so that we're just giving somebody a concrete resource if they need it?
Yes, it's 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E, 1-800-799-SAFE. And I couldn't agree with you more on that. I have found in my life that my heroes are the women who have been able to persevere through this. And I've met so many that have gone on and gotten to a better place. And they are some of the most remarkable individuals that I've ever met in my life. And like I said, they are my heroes, because I look at some of the things that I've gotten awards for, and pales in comparison to how they've navigated and still been able to persevere and do well.
Well said. And for the record, you are one of my heroes. So thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you all for listening. Please join me next week when my guest will be Dr. Janet Edgett. We'll be talking about the impact that bullying has on children. Until then, I know you have what it takes to take care of yourself. Be well. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. Please join Lisa Ferrance again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. May the next week be a positive, life-changing one for you. Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, President and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe, and
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.